You're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia, broadcasting to you on the 2nd of May 2014. My name's Hereward Fenton, and a very warm welcome to all our listeners around the world and in Austin, Texas on Logos Radio Network. It's a great pleasure to have your company today. We are going to be covering several important stories in today's show. I have two guests organised to come on during the two-hour broadcast today. In the second hour, I'm to be joined by Dr. Francis Boyle, Professor of International Law at the University of Illinois. And Dr. Boyle will be joining us for the full hour, and we will be going through a lot of really important topics, the main one being Dr. Boyle's work with the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission. But we will be expanding from that to consider the whole question of accountability for the powers that be in terms of major war crimes and crimes against humanity and torture that need to happen if we are to call ourselves a civilized civilization. The Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission took place in Malaysia a couple of years ago, and Dr. Boyle was a prosecutor in those proceedings, and I will be speaking to him in detail about those proceedings and what the outcomes were. And from what I understand, the outcomes have actually been quite significant. The commissions, of course, have not been accepted in the West largely, but it has affected the behaviour of some of the indicted figures, such as Dick Cheney and George Bush, because I think they are being advised that there are some legal concerns, and apparently when George Bush tried to attempted to travel to Switzerland recently, he changed his mind at the last minute, and the opinion of Dr. Boyle is that this was on advice from his lawyers, because they had been lobbying very strongly with Switzerland to take the indictment seriously. Of course, we cannot be sure about this, but it is extremely important to document what is going on here. And it's extremely important that justice and due process is actually taking place, even if it's being done in a manner which is not being acknowledged by those countries that are the culpable countries in these claims. So it's going to be very interesting talking to Dr. Francis Boyle, and we will be looking at some larger questions of the geopolitical stability of the Pacific, Australia and China. And Dr. Boyle certainly has some very sobering thoughts to give us about the future of our country, of Australia, as we appear to be heading into a global conflagration, which will certainly involve China and possibly Japan. So do stay tuned for that second hour. It's going to be really, really, really interesting. I have another guest scheduled for the first hour, and his name is Brendan O'Connell. This is an Australian story, and it's quite an eye-opener on the level of censorship and the draconian legislations that have been ushered through Parliament over the past few years, many of which people are completely unaware of. Brendan O'Connell went to prison for 3 years under recently enacted racial vilification laws. And I've had an opportunity to look at his at the videos that he was convicted for. He's basically a blogger, and he did some videos which were up on YouTube, and he has a gripe with the state of Israel, and he has a gripe with Jews, and I won't make any bones about that. I won't dispute that. He certainly does have grievances there, but this is a very important point for free speech and for really the future of a free society. If a person cannot simply express their views without threat of prison, this is a very, very serious situation. I mean, the man did not threaten anyone. He did not commit any acts of violence, and no one has accused him of that. And the complaints he's made about Israel and Jewish people are actually criticisms and accusations based on his perception that the Jewish state is oppressing the people of Palestine, the native indigenous people of that region, and he accuses them of being racist, and he accuses them of being homicidal. And this is actually done in his video, which was on YouTube. And this is actually the basis for his conviction, believe it or not. Now, some people have said that Brendan O'Connell is over the top, that his personality is abrasive, that he's a troublemaker. And you know what? I'm not going to dispute any of those claims. The point here is not that I'm saying, look at Brendan O'Connell, he's a wonderful human being. What I'm saying, and the reason I'm doing the interview today, is to highlight a situation that we are in now, where you can be imprisoned simply for expressing your views when it is deemed that those views are offensive on racial grounds by certain people. So Brendan O'Connell's claim that Jews are racist was itself treated as racism. I mean, that's an incredible thing, isn't it? Just to consider that. Brendan O'Connell accuses Jews of being racist, and then he is accused and convicted of being racist, and he is given the maximum possible sentence of 3 years, and he receives no parole. So these are very, very important questions to consider, ladies and gentlemen. This is the country you live in. These are the laws that are in place in your country. So we will be exploring all that in detail in the first hour. Okay, in the meantime, I'd like to run through some Australian stories with you today. First one I would like to talk about is a story that popped up on The Age on the 1st of May 2014. $40,000 fines loom for drunk and drugged drivers. Drivers caught behind the wheel while drunk and high could face huge fines of nearly $40,000 under Victorian law changes aimed at battling the state's road toll. The new laws, set to be introduced in state parliament later this month, will also see drivers who are intoxicated on alcohol and drugs lose their license for a year and have their vehicles impounded. A first offence will hit hard, with fines tipping past $4,000, while repeat offenders could face a maximum fine of $38,977 for driving on booze and drugs, depending on the number of previous offences. Now, the reason I bring this story to your attention is obviously it's the outrageous nature of this fine. It's not because I think that people should be able to drive when drugged and drunk. That's a terrible thing to do. However, these fines are themselves a terrible thing to do to anybody, because they're going to bankrupt people. And when you bankrupt someone, if that person already has a problem with drugs, that is only going to drive them deeper into whatever problem they've got. It's certainly not going it's not going to help them in any way, put it that way. And these are probably people who need help. Let's consider that point. But let's consider the question of whether it really acts as a deterrent. The people who are engaged in this sort of behaviour are already taking huge risks. I mean, the risk of killing yourself while driving is already quite significant and far more serious indeed. So people who are drunk and drugged are willing to take huge risks. So the fact that this outrageous fine has now gone into law is not going to make them suddenly think, oh, I better not do it. Oh, no, there's a big fine if I do it. And it's just ludicrous, right? And then the other question is, what is this money for? What is this vast amount of money for? Bear in mind, this is fines for people who are caught with blood alcohol or drug readings, right? It's not about accidents. So these people may not have done anything to hurt anyone. They're simply driving when drugged and intoxicated. So what is this money for? What is it even being used for? I mean, it is such an incredibly huge amount of money. But this is kind of the mentality now. The mentality which has crept into our lawmakers and crept into our society, where we think, oh, it's fine, it's great. You know, you've got to punish these people. You've got to send them a message. And it's just so wrong. It's so wrong on so many levels. I can just hardly begin to describe it. And it makes me so angry that this is being done. And just to give you another side of it, often these cases are wrong. Often they're fraudulent. Often the person has been misdiagnosed. The drug readings are incorrect. And in fact, sometimes people are on prescription drugs that can cause a positive reading. And sometimes the police can misuse these laws. So there are so many opportunities for corruption and tyranny to make their way through these laws. It is just shocking, folks, to see what is happening in this country. It is really, really shocking. And to see so little resistance, to see so little attempt from any part of the society to say, no, we will not accept this. So I merely bring that to your attention. I think it is a pretty important scenario, and there are probably a lot of other similar laws that have been sneaked through that I haven't been able to catch up with, but they're coming through all the time. Some other news. Tax returns are to be axed for 1.4 million Australians. Up to 1.4 million taxpayers will be freed from the hassle of completing a tax return and will receive a thank you receipt from the Treasurer. And there is now a move to what they call tick and flick tax returns. It's a red tape reduction measure. Now, what this is meant to be is a wonderful time-saving thing, and it also saves red tape. But the tick and flick measure requires you to accept a standardized way of calculating your tax deductions, and it actually just gives you a flat level, like a block amount that you're able to claim. We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to be with you today. I'll be right back after this short break.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Do check us out on the internet if you get a chance at www.truthnews.com.au and see if you can find our podcasts. Very easy to find there on the homepage, and you can subscribe to those. And you can also subscribe to our newsletter, and you can receive notifications of our shows, and you'll get an email containing the article that goes with each podcast show. So I do strongly encourage you to do that. And also, for listeners on Logos Radio, if you are looking for our podcast and you can't find them on Logos Network's podcast channel, come over to Truth News and you'll be able to get our podcasts. They're all here. Now, I've just been talking about this new tick and flick, as they say, tax return system that the Australian government is bringing in, and it all sounds wonderful because we're relieved of the requirement to provide all those niggling little details to the tax department. Instead, the government does it all for us in their wonderful loving kindness, and they decide for us everything, including what our tax deduction should be. We get two choices. We've got two boxes we can tick. We can tick a 500 or a 1,000 standard deduction. And you don't even have to prove that. You can just tick it, and you don't have to show any reason. You just tick the 500 or the 1,000. Isn't that kind? But, of course, anything outside that, and you can't. And, you know, $1,000 is not really very much, is it? I mean, anyone who's in business, $1,000, hello, you know, that's ludicrous. They're robbing you. It's a joke. The joke's on you. Okay. One other aspect of this lovingly prepared government-organized tax return is that Treasury will be using third-party information from real estate agents and stockbrokers to track taxpayers' capital gains with the long-term goal of offering a no-touch tax returns. So Treasury is going to track taxpayers' capital gains. So they're going to decide for you what your taxable income is when it's derived from investments. That sounds a little scary to me. That sounds like they're going to be probing into some of perhaps your personal affairs. Maybe they're just doing it on a purely statistical level, but that doesn't seem right either, because people's investment portfolios are all unique. This looks like they're going to basically take over the management of your taxation accounting. Oh, my goodness. Folks, you've got to pay attention to this. This is serious. But again, it's being coated. It's being presented as this wonderful sugar-coated pill, and it just looks so great because, gee, they're going to do all the work, and we all hate doing tax returns, don't we? So again, I do present this to you for your consideration, and I will be providing all the notes to these stories on the webpage. Now, I'd like to move on to something a little more serious. There have been some deaths of Australians recently in US drone strikes, and this has somewhat gone under the radar. We did get some reports from it in the mainstream news, of course, but really there was no big fuss about it. The government certainly didn't have any concerns that our citizens were being murdered. It's all fine, really, according to the government. Got an article here. The Abbott government defends the drone strike that killed two Australian al-Qaeda militants from April 17. The federal government has defended the killing of two Australian al-Qaeda militants in a US drone strike in Yemen late last year. A spokesman for the Department of Foreign Affairs told Fairfax Media that the Australian government had not raised any concerns whatsoever about the strike, believed to be the first time Australians have been killed under Washington's controversial drone program. Oh, goodness gracious me, yes. His comments came after it emerged that the two Australian men were among five al-Qaeda militants killed in a Predator drone strike in November in eastern Yemen. The two Australians have been described as foot soldiers for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the offshoot of the militant network in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. One man was named as Christopher Harbord of Townsville, And the other, a dual New Zealand national, went by the name Muslim bin John. They were not the main target of the attack. But, big deal. You know, no biggie. It's fine by us, buddies, if you want to kill some Aussies. Just go ahead. You don't even need to mention it. Don't even need to mention it. Just do it. The US has long used drone strikes to target key extremists in the Middle East. The program has been expanded dramatically under the Obama administration, sparking controversy in the US, but not in Australia, and some tensions with countries in the region. Oh, really? How surprising. I mean, gee, we just fly in with these unmanned aircraft and gun people down, or blow people up, and kill countless civilians and bystanders, and there's some tension created by that? Oh, how surprising. Controversy. Unheard of. But anyway, the department spokesman defended the strike. This is Australian Defence Department. Defended the strike, saying Australians could not expect to engage in potentially criminal activity without consequences. That's the exact quote. Yes, without consequences. They've been naughty. They're naughty, naughty little boys. And for that, they get blown apart and shredded. And their blood and guts spread out all over the desert. That's how we punish you. And remember, they haven't been convicted of anything. They never actually were afforded a trial. That's why I said potential criminal activity. We don't really know what they did. Obviously, they weren't the target. It's already been admitted they weren't the target. So they were just along for the ride. But, gee, you know, there they were with some Al-Qaeda militants. And, of course, you know, Al-Qaeda militants deserve death, all of them. They just must be killed immediately. And everyone knows that an Al-Qaeda militant is very easily identified because they have these kind of glowing red sort of embers in their head that you can actually see from satellite. It's quite amazing. Very, very easy to spot. And only the Al-Qaeda militants have these glowing red kind of beacons that allow the drone pilots to know who to kill with a precision pinpoint accuracy. Isn't it amazing? However, we have to admit that sometimes the guy sitting next to the guy with a glowing "I'm an Al-Qaeda militant" sign on his head does get killed too. Unfortunate. I mean, you know, these pinpoint surgical attacks are so precise and they take such concern to protect the innocent. But, you know, if you're sitting next to one of these people, you just take the risk, don't you? And you should know, because he'll have one of those little glowing red signs on his head, so he could never do it by mistake. So those Australians knew the risk they were taking. Oh, yes. Well, Australians are reminded that by engaging in any potentially criminal activity overseas, they accept the risk of serious consequences. The fact that they are Australian citizens is not a protection. So in any potentially criminal activity overseas, they are taking the risk of serious consequences. Doesn't get much more vague than that, does it? The New Zealand Prime Minister John Key said that he knew about this fellow, but again, John Key said he's not particularly concerned, and he said that drone strikes were legitimate at certain times when countries are trying to contend with very dangerous situations. So they're legitimate at certain times. Interesting, isn't it? I wonder what specific sections of international law or codes he's referring to and exactly when they are legitimate and at what times they are legitimate. I mean, is that like a calendar date? You know, it's legitimate to murder people with these weapons and splatter their guts all over the desert only from 2 to 3 p.m. on Thursdays. Anyway, that's about all I have for that story. We'll be back after the break with our guest. Do stay with us. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Thank you. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Great to have your company today. Now, unfortunately, our guest has not been able to make the interview today, Brendan O'Connell. I was looking forward to talking to him about the vilification trial and conviction that he sustained there in Western Australia. But it's not to be, unfortunately. I am going to return to the subject of Israel a little bit, though, in the second half hour. And we're also going to bring you a bit of information from the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, which we will be talking about in the second hour with my guest, Francis Boyle. But I have a recent report here from the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal, which is ongoing. There are various proceedings that are ongoing, as I understand it. And I have a report here which is published on the 24th of April, 2014, and I haven't actually had a chance to listen to the whole thing, so I'll be playing it for you. And it's about Israel, and it's about genocide. And so it's quite an interesting topic for our listeners and connected to the second hour of the show. So I'll just kick that off for you right now.
This is the National Mosque of Malaysia. It's Friday. There are thousands and thousands of people inside, and they're still arriving. Perhaps you can see them on that side of the screen. But there are entrances everywhere. Everyone, of course, takes off their shoes, and there's prayer, etc. Mahathir Mohamad was the fourth Prime Minister of Malaysia, and perhaps the most famous person from Malaysia. But he comes here every Friday. He defied the IMF, and he challenged Israel as to its actions. And that's more than we can say for any Western leader, or precious few on earth. So a very brave man. He also is the founder of a war crimes tribunal here in Kuala Lumpur. They rely on barristers from around the world, from different faiths, who hear court cases on war crimes, alleged war crimes. They don't profess to have jurisdiction around the world, but they're trying to change the mindset of people. And in history, we've seen this happen before. Slavery was abolished. In fact, war is a crime according to the United Nations. It can only exist if it's approved by the United Nations Security Council. And we've seen America defies that and goes to war and commits its atrocities without regard for the UN, and the same with Israel. So it's trying to raise the awareness. And just as we have Boy Scouts and various groups like that in our schools, they are starting criminal war clubs, and they hope to spread these around the world amongst the different schools. So they've passed a verdict on Israel that it committed genocide, also against an Israeli general. And they hear evidence from people. They had victims from Abu Ghraib in Iraq come here and testify. They've also passed judgment on 9/11. So it's a multi-denominational, multi-faith activity. Anyway, I'll read out some of the statements they've made. I'll show you some of their magazines, and hopefully I've got a CD of some of their activity when they're in session. But they're 100% legal in their methodology. They have all different departments that decide what will be heard, etc. So they also have a quarterly magazine they give out. A very impressive, well-meaning enterprise. Thanks to Mahathir Mohamad, who's always vocal against the atrocities against the Palestinians. And in fact, a lot of the uproar we see in Malaysia is a follow-on from his times. We've recently heard about Anwar Ibrahim being charged with various offences. Well, this stems from the time of the economic crisis in Southeast Asia. Basically, the IMF and whoever other secretive people crashed all the currencies in Southeast Asia, and the countries became bankrupt overnight, virtually. So they all had to go to the IMF to get a loan, and Anwar Ibrahim said, this is what we have to do in Malaysia. but Mahathir Mohamad defied the rest of Southeast Asia and the IMF, and Malaysia is now booming. And he turned the economy around within a couple of years without any help from the IMF. After considering the evidence adduced by the prosecution and submissions by both the prosecution and the amicus curiae team, on behalf of the two defendants, the tribunal is satisfied, beyond any reasonable doubt, that the first defendant, Amos Yaron, is guilty of crimes against humanity and genocide, and the second defendant, the State of Israel, is guilty of genocide. The defendant, Amos Yaron, the commander, Brigadier General Yaron, and the phalangist agreed that a phalangist liaison officer with communications equipment would be present at all times in the IDF command post with the Mossad liaison officer at the phalangist headquarters. Yaron knew about phalangist combat ethics. He was pleased with his decision and was quite content to have the phalangist participate and not leave the operation up to the IDF. Yaron could not explain his lack of action or intervention by the Israeli army to protect civilians when he learned on the first night, September 16th, after the intervention of the phalangists, that massacres were occurring. Even when Israeli military authorities were well aware of the exactions by the phalangists on Friday, the 17th of September, they did not intervene to protect the Palestinian civilians, but rather allowed them to bring in tractors to do what they wanted. The following testimony confirms that from the command posts, the Israelis, including, of course, Brigadier Commander Amos Yaron, could see into the camps and observe the massacres. From the command post, it was possible to see into the camps, even into the narrow alleys. One could see the mass grave 300 meters away, dug by the phalangists, and the bulldozer used to bury the hundreds of victims. There was a clear symbiotic relationship between Israel and the Christian forces, the Lebanese Maronite Christian militia, known as the Phalangists, or Kitaib, assisted by the Israeli Mossad. Even the uniforms of the South Lebanese Army and the Phalangists were the same as those of the IDF, and provided by Israel. The Israelis exercised some degree of control of the SLA. The Phalangists' plan to use force to remove Palestinians was discussed at several meetings with Israel.
Yeah, we'll just leave it there. The points that the speaker there, and I'm sorry I don't have attribution for that clip, but it's posted on YouTube without any identification of who the person is, but a nice little coverage there of what's going on in Malaysia. But the points there made about Anwar Ibrahim are related to the fact that Anwar Ibrahim has been convicted of sodomy in Malaysia. He is actually the leader of the opposition party in Malaysia, but there have been attempts to jail him, and he was actually jailed at one point and then released, and now again he has been convicted once more of sodomy. But this casts some doubt on the validity of the Malaysian legal system, because it does have this very heavy emphasis on Islamic law and Sharia law, and sodomy is regarded as a very, very serious crime in Malaysia, whereas in the rest of the world, or certainly in Western countries, it's really just a personal matter, and it's not something that could be used, could be considered in any kind of criminal matter, unless it was connected to rape. However, the revelations made in the video I just played, that Anwar Ibrahim had tried to stitch up Malaysia in a loan through the IMF, suggest that the reasons why the establishment there may be trying to put him in prison may be due to the fact that they are trying to prevent Malaysia from going down that path. And as he said, Malaysia has been hugely economically successful. Now, I'm certainly not justifying these arcane laws, but and I don't generally approve of these attempts of governments to persecute individuals at all. However, the situation may be a little more complex, and it's interesting to find out more about it. We are going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to be with you today. Do stay on for the second hour because we have a very important guest, Professor Francis Boyle from the University of Illinois, Professor of Political Science, will be coming on to talk about his work with the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, and he'll be going through some of the cases there and the types of crimes that were investigated and prosecuted. He was actually a prosecutor at that tribunal, and his involvement was a couple of years ago. But this is an ongoing institution within Malaysia, and as I showed you there in the previous segment, they're doing a lot of work, and they're involved in exposing war crimes of all kinds, and they've got a particular interest in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Professor Boyle will be talking about some of the indictments that he was involved in. He was actually a prosecutor, and he'll be talking about the crime against peace that was the charges that were laid and the conviction that was obtained there under the Nuremberg statutes. And he'll also be talking about the crimes of torture that American officials have been charged with, including very high level. It goes right up to the top. So that is going to be a very interesting discussion with Dr. Boyle in the second hour. Meanwhile, let's return a little to some Australian news. Once again, returning to questions about tax, a very odd thing happened in the news. We heard that the government was planning to launch a new tax, and this is what they're calling a debt tax. And I've got an article here from a couple of days ago. Prime Minister Tony Abbott is facing dissent from within his own party over a proposal to introduce a debt levy, with one MP saying it would be absolutely crazy and amount to a broken election promise. Mr. Abbott says the government is mulling over a range of ideas, but has confirmed he's considering a temporary levy to help repay the nation's debt. Now, this to me is quite an extraordinary thing. I've never heard of anything like this in our history, and there have certainly been many cases in the past where we've been in debt, where there's been a deficit. But the idea that the government should just raise money directly from the people to pay it is quite scary, actually, and it hints at other possibilities that we've already been warned about. For example, the bank bail-in options, which we saw the example of in Cyprus a couple of years ago, where savings accounts were skimmed. And again, that was to sort of rescue banks. But there is always a close connection between the government national debt and the banking system. I don't know enough about it to be able to say for certain whether this is in any way connected to that type of possibility. But it is a very similar type of solution to the problem. It is a type of a bail-in solution where we, the taxpayers, we, the citizens, are expected to cough up and pay off some debt that really we shouldn't be responsible for. I mean, the government manages the government. We manage our own finances. So it's very odd. I don't really even say I fully understand it. But let me play you here a recent clip from ABC talking about this very thing.
Tax cuts with no new taxes, that was the repeated promise of Tony Abbott in opposition. But now the Prime Minister has confirmed a temporary tax hike for higher income earners is under discussion in Cabinet. It's just one measure provoking heated debate in the lead-up to the budget. Plans to change the aged pension after the next election are also causing concern. Political correspondent Sabra Lane has traded Parliament House for the local seniors club to find out more.
Pensioners and retirees are thrilled to be stretching and flexing in their weekly exercise class. They're not happy, though, that change looms large over future age pension payments.
I would hate to think in 3 years' time he's going to whack a bit more off the pension, because I don't think I could afford to lose anything more than I have now. I live on my own. My husband died 7 years ago. Maybe I should downsize the house, but I don't know what I'd get for the house now. Those things worry me.
If Tony Abbott's re-elected at the next election, he says the age pension will be altered. He'll raise the eligibility age further, probably to 70 by 2030, and the indexation rate, at which payments increase to take into account inflation, will be dropped to a less generous rate in 3 years, pending ballot box approval.
With four out of five seniors on the pension, the number of workers per retiree dropping from five to three by 2050, and more than 1,000 people becoming eligible for the age pension every single week, long-term reform is essential and unavoidable.
Paulette Raisin is a part pensioner.
Well, they want us to contribute, and that's fair enough, but why not start from the top and work down? I feel pensioners have worked all their lives. They should be able to enjoy some of that without the government taking more away from things going up, therefore their pension income is less.
We welcome the decision to push it back and enable it to be part of the election next time around. I think that overcomes any of the debate around promises or whatever else.
National Seniors Australia's Michael O'Neill had an audience with the Treasurer today and acknowledges some recipients shouldn't be getting the part pension.
Look, I think that needs to be part of the review, that there will be folk who...
Right, we'll just leave it there. Obviously, a large part of that report there was about raising the age at which people can receive the pension. Now, that, of course, is also a very, very significant matter. And raising it from 65 to 70, it really does change things quite substantially. And, I mean, it's quite, quite an amazing thing to think that... that in the future, people are going to be expected to be able to pull an income up to the age of 70. Of course, there have been a lot of improvements in life expectancy over the decades, and for me personally, I hope that I'm able to continue working up until I die, whatever age that is, because for me, work is life. It's work, this type of work, and doing a show like this, which I consider to be real work, is something that I would consider that I would like to do till any age, as long as I'm able to speak. But of course, for a lot of people, work is not something that they necessarily get any pleasure in, and in many cases, people simply can't continue working if it's a heavy labour type of work they've been involved in. If they're not able to for other health reasons. So really raising it to 70 is it's pretty harsh. But all the signs are that we are moving into a much, much harsher society. Now, let's just return to this question about the tax for debt. I've got a recent story here just from today. Treasurer Joe Hockey says that the proposed debt tax is a call to arms for the nation to help repair the budget deficit. Mr. Hockey has refused to rule out the prospect of the federal government raising income tax through a deficit levy on those earning higher incomes. The Treasurer also confirmed that the Coalition wants to raise the pension entitlement to 70. So let's play here another clip from the ABC talking about this story.
Tony Shepherd, of course, is the author of that Commission of Audit speaking in Canberra at the moment. Let's have a look.
I think they're reasonable. I think we've done it in a fair way, an incremental way, and tried not to disadvantage anybody at the present time and bring them in over time. So I'd be unhappy to think that they thought that was unfair and not reasonable.
Have you had much response from the government about what they think of the recommendations?
They've told me they've taken it very seriously, and it's informed their, you know, their future plans, and they'll let the whole world know at the time of the budget, you know, which recommendations they will accept and which they'll consider and which they'll reject, and that's their right as government. We're not elected, we're just advisers.
What do you think the possibility is of a lot of the recommendations being implemented?
Well, look, I'm not sure on that, on how many they will accept and how many they'll look at seriously.
OK, well, that's obviously a load of gobbledygook. Just to clarify, the Commission of Audit was actually organised by the government, and it was their recommendation to actually bring in this tax. So, again, the government is able to say, well, the experts have decided that that this is the best way to do it, and we're just going along with their recommendations. Now, I have more information on this story from heraldsun.com.au, and the leaked information is suggesting that Australians earning $80,000 or more will be hit with a debt tax of at least $800 per year. So it's actually quite significant. And I have a news clip from the site here, which I'll just play for you briefly now.
The government has clearly decided to hit higher income earners with a deficit levy. The precise details of that deficit levy, we'll have to wait until the budget to see what they are. But broadly, it's going to have a two-tier levy, much like the flood levy of the Gillard government a few years ago, where you pay a certain percentage of your income up to a certain level and a higher percentage beyond that level. The cutting point is going to be $80,000. Anybody earning less than $80,000 won't pay any of the levy. Above $80,000, it looks like it's going to be 1% and then 2% when you hit the top marginal tax rate at $180,000. This is clearly designed to demonstrate that the sharing the pain of fixing the budget is going to go right across the community.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. I think this is... This whole situation suggests that there are big problems coming. This is kind of like an emergency measure. Do stay with us for the second hour. Very, very important guest, Francis Boyle, coming on to talk about the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal. We'll see you at the beginning of the second hour.